This broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is recorded, so we're not taking any new phone calls.
For joining us, I'm Diane Rehm with his Concrete, Steel, and Glass. Modern architecture can seem dark and austere, more a work of art than a place of warmth, shelter, and hospitality. But in his novel, The Glass Room, Simon Maw imagines the loves and losses, passions and betrayals of the occupants of a Czechoslovakian house based on a real architectural masterpiece. Joining us in the studio for this month's Reader's Review, architect Susan Piedmont Palladino, Washington Post fiction editor Ron Charles, and attorney Bernard Lambeck. We are talking about The Glass Room, a novel breathtakingly beautiful. And I'm not sure how many of you out there have heard about it, read about it, but we loved it so much. We wanted to bring it to your attention. I understand that you, Ron Charles, wrote one of the very, very few reviews of this book in the United States.
Yeah, I had coffee with the publisher a few weeks ago, and she said the Post was the only paper to review this novel in the United States.
Extraordinary.
Particularly when you think it was a finalist for the Booker Prize. And the other two other finalists got enormous attention here.
Now, what I want to point out to our listeners before we begin is that you, Bernie Lambeck, you are an attorney, but you're also the grandson of Greta Tugendhat, who, with her husband Fritz Tugendhat, engaged the architect Ludwig Mies van der Rohe to build the house in Czechoslovakia, which inspired this novel.
Right, that's right. Greta Tugendhat was my grandmother, and my mother was her first child. And my mother grew up in the house, in fact, from about age 6 to about age 13.
And surely you've seen the house.
I have. We went there in 2002 and did a tour. It's being operated by the city of Brno now as a museum, and it's open to the public. And we did do a tour.
And I also want to tell our listeners that photographs of this extraordinary house are at our website. You can go to the link at our website, drshow.org. You can see the most gorgeous photographs of this house by going to that website, drshow.org. Now, let's talk about the book, The Glass Room. And I'm going to start with you, architect Susan Piedmont Palladino. Was the story primarily the house? How did the house become such a central figure?
Well, it's an amazing, to me, description of a piece of architecture as a character in the novel. When I was reading it, I, in fact, wrote down and have run this question by a lot of people, couldn't we begin to teach the entire history of architecture through literature? Because wrapped up in this is the whole, not just the architecture as an exquisite object and as a masterpiece of modernism, but the whole cultural soup, the politics, the side effects of modernism, the unintended consequences, the paradoxes of the modernist dream and its dark side, and the sort of paradox of the material of glass. And because I'm an architect, I read the book like an architect and am more interested in the life and times of the house maybe than the characters. But it's also a wonderful way of telling, reminding us that architecture is in the world. It's not a thing apart. Mm. And so the house is in history and a part of it and makes it. And I was telling someone I just need another sabbatical so I can redo a whole course proposal on learning about architecture through literature.
Ron Charles, you read this book and I think loved it as much as I did.
I did. And what impressed me, what you remind me of, Susan, is how much the book is about how this house affects the people who live in it, but not in the way they expect. They expect and they... Of course, they celebrate how freeing it's going to be, how transparent they'll be made by living in this
glass house.
Right. And they think that's going to be wonderful. But then when you really think about what it would be like to be made transparent, I mean, who of us could live in a glass house, for real or metaphorically?
It's interesting that the central character talks about the idea there will be no secrets.
Yes.
And, of course, the novel is filled with secrets.
Yeah, that's a lot of psychological violence to imagine you're not going to have any interior private life. And, of course, it warps all these characters.
Yeah. Bernie, tell us what it's like in this house, what it's like to be in it.
Well, it is a gorgeous house. What the book does beautifully is it captures the feeling that the actual inhabitants had about the house. It captures well. I mean, that the characters Liesl and Victor Landauer, who are in many ways not similar to Grete Tugendhat and her husband Fritz Tugendhat, but in the way they feel about the house, he's captured that perfectly. They have this. And they talked about the house in this sort of lyrical way that the characters in the book talk about the house. And they had rather grand feelings about the notions of truth and beauty that could be found in this house.
How did your mother feel about living in the house?
My mother died in 1991, so I don't have her as a resource, unfortunately. She had very good memories of the house, but I think it's, you know, she had good memories of her family there, and nothing was the same after that, of course. The real family went to Switzerland in 1938, which is what happens to the fictional family, and then the real family went to Venezuela in 1941, and then went back, most of them went back to Europe in 1950.
But never lived in the house again.
Never lived in the house again.
Yes. Right. Ron, what were your first impressions of Liesl and Victor Landauer?
That they were incredibly naive about the future. I mean, Nazism is already simmering in Germany, and Victor is going on and on in these parties and giving these toasts about the clear and beautiful future that awaits us and the peace that will sweep through Europe. And, of course, for us as readers, you know, we feel all the heavy irony of these lines. And it seemed a little forced to me at first, but then I thought about the way we talk about the internet and the web, and you can hear the same kind of silly, almost ridiculous optimism about the way that will transform the
but
world.
But yet, Susan, I mean, the couple was so attracted to the architect's vision of what this home would be.
Right, and I think this question of seeing clearly, that the glass house transparency, the whole modernist project of breaking down social barriers, class barriers, and sort of away with the old world and in with the new, it comes, you know, glass is so central to it as a material and as a metaphor. And what's so interesting is, again, Victor's proclamation that we'll all be able to see so clearly. But the property of glass also allows it to completely blind you. So there's this theme of extreme transparency and visibility and then a blindness that's literal when Liesl loses her sight, but she's has a hard time seeing. You know, she always has to put her glasses on. But when the light is on one side of a glass window, the people with the light can see out. I mean, the people without the light can see out, and then the other side is blinded. So there's a privileged view that comes with glass. So it has this illusion of complete transparency, but there's actually a kind of power to either side of it. So they're blind at the same time they think they can see everything, which to me is a great paradox.
And, of course, there is this onyx wall. Yeah. What is that onyx wall? How does that you've seen it.
Is it there? Is it real?
Yeah. Oh, yes. Yeah,
the onyx wall
there.
Is still there. I mean, there's other things
Absolutely.
In the house that aren't there. The original wooden semicircular dining room wall is not the original, but the onyx wall is still there.
And
the
we
original.
Have a photograph. We have a link to the photograph of the actual house. So I think our listeners are going to enjoy seeing that. Is Rainer von Abt very closely based on Ludwig Wies van der Rohe?
I don't think so.
You don't.
To me, he's based more on our standard caricature of the architect, which we really get from Frank Lloyd Wright, which is the sort of hero autocratic figure who sweeps in to the situation, takes control of the client's lives, gives them something they may or might not have actually expected, and then sweeps off again. And I think that Mies might have made kind of a dull character in the novel. So I think the architect, in my view, he's one of the less believable characters, but that's partially because as an architect we're highly sensitive to how we're portrayed in the media, I think. And he does have that kind of Frank Lloyd Wright character. I mean, I kept picturing him in my mind as Wright. And the way he's described, I think he's relatively short, if I remember correctly. He's a shorter stature. And Mies was sort of an imposing presence. And Wright was quite small. And so I always pictured Frank Lloyd Wright in my mind whenever they talked about von Abt.
And I must say, von Abt has kind of an hypnotic effect on Liesel. Certainly early on in the book, and even a little later. We're going to take just a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk further about Simon Maw's book. It's titled The Glass Room, and Maw, by the way, is spelled M-A-W-E-R.
Coming up Monday on the Kojo Nandi Show, how we measure charter schools' performance and whether they're living up to their promise. Our newest education series continues. Plus, marrying later and maintaining dual careers, what the shifting power balance means to today's married couples. The Kojo Nandi Show, noon till 2 Monday on WAMU 88.5.
In the Washington area, information is a hot commodity, and that information is available on NPR Mobile. It provides the latest news through the web browser on your mobile device at wamu.npr.org. Listen to local headlines, weather, and traffic. Plus, get national headlines and the story of the day from NPR. WAMU 88.5 and NPR. Information on demand at wamu.npr.org.
This broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is recorded. So we're not taking any new phone calls.
Just before the break, as we are talking about the glass room, I know you, Bernie, wanted to say something about the relationship between the two people who are at the center of this book.
Well, I was actually going to respond for a moment about the architect and whether the extent to which he may be similar to Mies van der Rohe, the real architect. And I don't know nearly so much about Mies, but what my grandmother wrote in 1969 when she was reflecting about her meeting with him, she said the very first moment we met him, it was clear to us that he should be the one to build our house. So impressed were we by his personality.
Wow.
So so their relationship, or at least my grandmother's relationship with Mies, may have had something of a similar character to Lisa Landauer's relationship to the fictional architect.
Now, it's interesting to me how this author has, I mean, to the extent that you just mentioned may have gotten into the minds of the real people who bought this house?
Well, I think he did. I mean, the source that I just read from, where my grandmother gave a talk in 1969, Simon Marr has also read that paper.
I see.
So he knows something about
knows
the real individuals.
He knows a fair amount, yeah. What do you think of the relationship then between Victor and Liesel? Were they truly in love at the beginning, or was Victor very wealthy? Was Liesel very wealthy? What attracted the two of them to begin with, Ron?
It doesn't stay a very romantic relationship very long,
sure,
of course.
Sure doesn't.
I think both of them are swept up with the images that they project of one another, and that, of course, falls apart after pretty quickly. And pretty soon, Victor is off. I don't know how much we want to give away, but he's cheating on his wife, basically. And she grows sort of cold and satisfied in her own isolation. It's a sad relationship, particularly in that it has to keep going for so long after the love has faded away.
It's extraordinary that Victor meets this young woman who works as both a waitress in a restaurant, but she also spends time as a prostitute. And Victor totally becomes, I won't say obsessed, but it gets pretty close to that, doesn't it?
He does get pretty obsessed. And to go back to the Victor Liesel relationship, which was interesting to try to sort through, the two characters remain a little bit enigmatic to me. But like the house and the whole sort of promise of modernism, they both really wanted everything's going to be perfect. You know, we're going to marry and everything's going to be perfect.
And ignoring what's happening around them, both intimately and internationally.
There's a point where Victor and Liesel finally talk it out and they confess what's been going on. And that chapter ends with Liesel saying, "I don't want to hear mention of it again." Mm-hmm. Boom. And they never do.
So she just wants to continue her life as is. But one character we haven't mentioned is her best friend, Hannah.
Yes.
And Hannah is a really important character in this book, Bernie.
Oh, absolutely. Almost the central character, because in the second half of the book, she plays an equally large role, while the Landauers are don't play such a large role in the second half of the book. There was a real friend of my grandmother's, a very close friend, but I don't think the Hannah character in the book is really modeled after her.
Why do you believe Hannah plays such an important role in the second half of the book? Talk about that role.
Well, she's the family, the Landauer family, leave Czechoslovakia.
Why?
Why do they leave? Well, they leave because in the book, Victor Landauer is Jewish. His wife is not Jewish. In real life, the couple were both Jewish. And they leave in early 1938 when Hitler has gone into Austria already. He is threatening to take over what was known as the Sudetenland in the northern part of Czechoslovakia, which he did take over shortly thereafter. And later on, he invaded Czechoslovakia completely, and it became part of the Third Reich. So they escape. Hannah Kova, the character that you mentioned, is not Jewish, although her husband is. And they don't leave. Her husband, neither of them has a good fate, but she is spending time in a large part of the plot of this second half of the book is she is figuring out ways to survive in that atmosphere.
And boy, does she.
Yeah, Hannah to me is the most fascinating character. She's actually my favorite character in the book, and I think she's the sort of person, if you knew her, she would drive you crazy. You would like her. She would irritate you.
She'd come on to you.
Yes, she's quite the character. But what's fascinating about her is she's quite resourceful and pragmatic.
Right.
which allows her to see what's going on, allows her to really, in a way, control her own fate in a way that the other characters who are sort of ideological to one degree or another can't seem to manage their lives. And so she's the one who, in the end, sort of stays herself, I think.
And more than any others, she represents the transparency of the house, because she not only is completely open about her own feelings, but she tells other people what they're feeling to their discomfort.
Right.
And she's the only character who's ironic, who's sarcastic. Everyone else is, as you say, caught up in the thrill of different ideologies, and she sees through it from the very beginning.
She is one tough lady. Let's open the phones, 800-433-8850. As this is a reader's review, I do want to encourage you to join us, whether you've read the novel or not. The Glass Room, Simon Marr is the author. He was a finalist for the 2009 Man Booker Prize for the novel, The Glass Room. Let's go to Rochester, New York. Good morning, Keith. You're on the air.
Yes, part of my ethnicity is German, and I want to use the house itself as an allegory to the negative. I'm always fascinated by human nature, that in the same way that we would get out of the way of an oncoming truck, that people in Europe at that time, with the rise of the Nazis, and I've asked within my family, because I never hyphenate, but for this one time as a German-American, the heavy burden that we carry, I've asked twofold, what was it about us as Germans and our perceived hatred of the Jewish people? Maybe your guest could comment on just the oh-so-hopefulness of human nature that something will work out. I read of a Jewish family that was lost because the mother did not want to leave behind the family piano. She put such a high regard on their culture and what that piano meant that the family was lost to the Holocaust. And just this intensity that I have of... even though German is not the only ethnicity in our family, but just as I stated, the burden that Germans overall, even us as Americans, have that out of the land of Bach and so on, all that is looked upon good about German and things German, that our people did this to the Jewish people and all of the others, gays and so on, gypsies, all of them.
Yes.
But the hopefulness of that house, just the whole idea that, oh, in 1929, even with storm clouds rising, that we can build this house and get away with it. That exact term, get away with it, and that what's going on in the world will not directly affect us.
All right. All right. Thanks, Keith. And that gets to the very question of whether Victor is an idealist, or is he a realist, or is he, as our caller suggested, just totally wanting to ignore everything around him. You've got something you want to read there.
Yeah, Victor's dream went with the spirit of a brand new country, he says here, in which they found themselves, a state in which Czechoslovakia, German or Jew, would not matter, in which democracy would prevail and art and science would combine to bring happiness to all people. I mean, this is a pretty powerful idea. It motivates a lot of good, a lot of building, a lot of what you need a society to feel in order to progress. But, of course, it can also trap people when they don't recognize the signs. And as is Victor, we should say, I mean, he's the one who realizes they have to get out also.
Susan.
Well, I think also modernism itself, the whole idea that architecture and city planning would actually be the instruments of that optimism. And, I mean, architecture is optimistic always. To design a house like this, to design anything, is not only to assume that you're going to make the world better by having done it, otherwise what's the point, but that there's going to be a world in which it's going to be, it's going to come alive. And so there's always an optimism to architecture.
And in and of itself, it's going to make things better.
Right. And I think the tragedy of some of the consequences of the modern movement was architecture can't do it alone, and that there are limits to that utopian vision of the modernist city and the modernist house.
But that modernist vision also goes to the fact that Victor falls in love with Kata, the other young woman. Is he at the same time still loving his wife, or can that not be, Bernie?
I don't know the answer to that. I mean, in some ways, yes, he continues to love his wife in the book, and in other ways, he doesn't understand what he's feeling. He certainly doesn't feel the same passion for her that he feels
right.
for Kata.
And yet, when they do try to leave the country, and she has another kind of passport, as I recall, and therefore she, Kata, and her daughter are taken away at the railroad station and cannot leave.
I was a wreck during that scene.
I know.
Oh, my gosh. It's just gripping and horrible. It happens almost accidentally, almost at the Well, of course, we're ruining this moment for your readers, but don't expect it at all. It really seems like they've gotten out, and then just one little hitch, and the whole thing falls apart.
I know.
Which must have happened over and over again in real life.
You're frowning, Bernie.
Well, the deep emotion of that section of the book is that, to me, is that Liesl is so angry at her husband.
Absolutely.
Because her husband cares more about what's happening to Kata than he does about his own family.
And she finally realizes that at that very moment.
Well, he did put them all at risk, though. I mean, the whole family could have gone down by his efforts to save his mistress. She has to think of her own children.
Exactly. And the book we're talking about is titled The Glass Room by Simon Marr. And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Here's a caller in Birmingham, Alabama. Good morning, Susan.
Good morning, Diane. I just wanted to say, first of all, thanks so much for talking about this book. I discovered this book myself. I write a book column for Birmingham Magazine, and I've told my readers about it. But I discovered it quite by accident, and because I love the Man Booker books, generally picked it up. My book group discussed this about a week and a half ago.
Oh, good.
We had the best time, and we were also looking at the same photographs. One thing I wanted to say is, almost to the person, even though the wall was described as being light-colored, we all pictured it as being black.
You know, when they talked about onyx, I had exactly the same reaction, because at one time I had an onyx ring, and so I thought it was black, but going to the photographs, it certainly isn't black.
No, it's not black. No. It's golden.
Yes, it's golden. And the depiction of the sun hitting that onyx wall is just so vivid. How did your book club feel about the book, Susan?
Well, there were a couple of things, and your guests have touched on a few of them. We also read Frank about Frank Lloyd Wright, and we also pictured the architect as being very similar to Frank Lloyd Wright. We liked the book. The one thing we were fascinated in the fact that the house is a character, and if I'm not mistaken, I believe this house is either mentioned or described or as character in every chapter. And we just thought that was fascinating, the way he was able to keep this house as an actual changing character.
Absolutely, because it does evolve in terms of the people who then begin to inhabit it.
Yeah, I want to go back to the onyx for a minute, because one of the things that struck me in this is, with all of the glass and the transparency and the lightness that we've talked about, the light that comes through the onyx wall, every time that's talked about at sunset, they talk about it in flames or this red, this burning light.
Right.
in contrast to the kind of cool, white, constant light that you think of, people often think of this house, and it's described this way, as cold. The people who are wondering why they're building this, well, it's going to be this cold house. And there's this flaming light of sunset that comes through the onyx, which is translucent, which, again, talks about, in some ways, the secrets of the house. I mean, to me, that's it's this anomaly in the house and this material that's really rich and transforms the light.
Susan, I wonder how your group reacted to all of the rather vivid sexuality in the book.
we didn't talk about that very much, except to say, you know, Hannah, wow. is there anyone that Hannah did not like? She was a really cool character, and we weren't disturbed by it. I think that the violence of the section at the train station and the suddenness and just how wrenching that was made more of an impression on us.
I see. Susan, thank you so much for calling. I'm glad your book club enjoyed it. I have the feeling that there are going to be lots of book clubs around the country reading this book, and I promise you, it's a very worthwhile read. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, your email, your phone calls. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. By the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. This is NPR.
Good morning. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show on WAMU 88.5. A Prairie Home Companion is coming up next at 11. If you've been a contributing member of WAMU 88.5 for years, consider making a bequest. It could be a better way of meeting your charitable giving needs, and it could also provide WAMU 88.5 with much-needed support for years to come. Check with your financial advisor or visit WAMU.org and click on support. And thank you.
WAMU 88.5 is proud to be a media sponsor for the 10th Annual Flamenco Festival, starting this Friday, running through February 23rd at GW's Lisner Auditorium. This year's gala will feature four new figures in flamenco dance. The gala will be Tuesday, February 9th at 8 p.m. More information is at WAMU.org under calendar.
This week on Interfaith Voices, it's an introduction to holy relics, the bones, fingers, tongues, and other body parts of long-dead religious leaders.
It's really just a hair. There's not much more to it than that. And yet the meaning that the people around it bring to it, that's what gives it its real significance and its power.
I'm Maureen Fiedler. Join me Sunday afternoon at 3 as we discover the sacred in human remains.
Today at 3 on WAMU 88.5.
This broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is recorded, so we're not taking any new phone calls.
And welcome back to our discussion of Simon Marr's The Class, The Glass Room. It's a beautiful novel. It was a finalist for the 2009 Man Booker Prize. Let's read this email. The Post was not alone in reviewing The Glass Room. A review of the book appeared in the New York Times book section January 24th. The single long paragraph appeared on the Fiction Chronicle, page 14. Its tone was unenthusiastic. I liked the book very much, was intrigued by the European feel of the writing, as well as the European story it tells. I, too, was intrigued by the manner in which the house was used after the inhabitants, after the owners, after the builders moved out. There was an evolution of tone. There was an evolution of period. You had a sense of history moving on. Ron Charles.
Mao. How do you pronounce his name?
Maur. It's M-A-W-E-R. I don't know if it's Maur or Maur. Maur.
Okay.
Let's say Maur.
Maur. Okay. He's an Englishman living in Italy, but I felt, I wondered what you felt, that the book sounded as though it was written in translation. It has a kind of odd old-world formality about it and a lot of attention to the foreign words, even though he claims in the end that he doesn't speak German or Czech. He certainly seems to.
He was born in England and spent his childhood there in Cyprus and in Malta.
But the characters are often talking about language and different words they want to use and how those meanings are shifting on them in a very interesting way.
But for me, I mean, the sadness with the book comes once it's taken over, the house is taken over after the Nazis invade and how things change.
Yeah, some very different people come through the house. A German geneticist trying to prove Hitler's racial theories, which is a really creepy and unnerving scene.
Oh,
even though no
boy.
Violence takes place
yeah,
in the house,
right.
It is really awful. And then it's used as a therapy clinic for handicapped children. There's dancing in the house. The house remains, as we've said, and yet everything about it inside changes.
Let's go to Richmond, Virginia. Good morning, Julie Ellen. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
A few years ago, I was in Paris and went to the Villa Savoye, which is by Le Corbusier. And what struck me about this conversation is that the house in the book and Corbusier's house are very similar in time and history. The Villa Savoye was also occupied during World War II and fell into disrepair. But what struck me there was actually being there was the light in the house and the colors. We often think that modern architecture is all black and white, but it really is amazing to be there, and that's not always captured in the photographs we see.
Yeah, I'm glad you you brought that up about Corbusier's Villa Savoye. One of the reasons I think we think modern architecture is black and white is the photography was black and white, and many of us, I mean, that sounds like sort of a glib answer, but so many of us, when we studied architecture, we looked at the old black and white photos, and Corbusier's architecture is really vivid. I mean, he was a painter, sort of full of life. But he's also the one who notoriously made the statement that a house is a machine for living, which is quoted and discussed in the book. And that's one of the most argued about modernist aphorisms, along with Mises' less is more and ornament is a crime, and all of these show up in the book. And that machine-like quality, which I always understand that phrase as the house is a machine to enable living, right? It's a way to make our lives better. That's, I guess, my positive take on it. But the machine-like quality of the house when the Nazis take over the house sort of turns that optimism of that phrase over.
Exactly.
And it becomes the embodiment of this nightmarish machine. And again, the house, physically, the house isn't really changed, but it's completely transmogrifies. It becomes something else because of how it's been re-inhabited, which is ominous.
And, of course, one of the servants in the house, when Liesl and Victor are living there, becomes part of the Nazi apparatus and is there as kind of the watchdog for the house, Bernie.
No, that's right. And that happened in real life, too, to some extent. The chauffeur of the Tugendhats stayed on in the house for some time. He was very close to the family. He wasn't like the character in the
who
book.
Who is kind of creepy, wouldn't you say?
Who is certainly creepy. And
yeah.
the character Liesl feels he's very creepy. And Whether that has any relationship to the real people or not, I doubt. But
Julie Ellen, thanks for calling. Let's go to Falmouth, Massachusetts. Good morning, Stephen. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. My name, well, you know my name. So my book club read this book the beginning of January. We absolutely loved it.
Oh, I'm so glad.
And I wrote to the author, and the previous caller mentioned that the house is like a character, which I had the same opinion. However, in a letter with the author, I'll read the line from the author's letter, Simon Mauer. Certainly, I did consider the house the pivot of the book. Every scene that took place away from the building was, during the writing, a bit of agony. But I'm not sure whether that makes it count as a character because it is unchanging and indifferent to what happens, a point made in the book in various places.
Hmm.
And anyways...
So, Stephen, what you're saying is you wrote to Simon Mauer because you enjoyed the book as thoroughly as you did, and he was gracious enough to respond.
Absolutely. He wrote back within probably 5 minutes. I was shocked.
Oh, how wonderful.
And, also, I wrote a review, and I told friends, I'm 48, but I told friends from college, pick this up. Don't be deceived by the cover or the weight of the book. It's 416 pages, but this is my new favorite book.
Yeah,
so I'm so glad you did this on your show.
Oh, good. Thanks for calling, Stephen. Do you want to comment, Bernie?
No, I'll pass it along.
Okay. I just wonder about book clubs reading this book, and perhaps had they seen that cover of the hardback that you have, they might have been perhaps more attracted. What do you all think? I see a decided difference in the cover, which is filled with color and light, and it's vivid somehow. This seems a little imposing. What do you think?
It's a little more romantic.
You think?
Well, than this.
Uh-huh.
But
yes, to me, the cover we're looking at, the paperback version with the sort of soft focus image of the two people's lips and chins, very much makes you think it's going to be a soap opera.
Right.
And
right.
The cover that we're looking at from the hard copy is on the cover is what looks to be a sort of cubist, almost purist painting.
Right.
And the dilemma between the two covers is they sort of emphasize the two different themes. One
right.
is really the lives of these fascinating characters, and the other is really kind of about modernism and, you know, you could read an awful lot into that cover because, of course, we do judge books by their covers.
Yeah, that's true.
We should note, too, that the only version available in this country is the paper version from a publisher called The Other Press.
Yeah. Did you, Bernie, ever have an opportunity to talk with the author?
I did have some email exchanges with the author.
Tell me about that.
Sure. Well, I happened to come across the book when I was in Europe visiting my aunt in Zurich, and she had a copy after it was first published in Britain. And I read it while I was in Europe and became so interested in it. So I did email Simon Mauer, and I was interested particularly in what his sources were, whether he had learned anything outside of the public realm, so to speak, about the family. And he was very kind to respond, and we exchanged a few emails. And the response to the basic question was, no, all his information was from publicly available sources.
And those publicly available sources would have included the lecture that your grandmother gave regarding the house.
Right. They included that, which is published. There's a book that my aunt, Daniela Hammer-Tugendhat, who lives in Vienna, and who is an art historian, published a book with others. She wrote some of it, and there are other contributors. And it's about the house and about the family. It's really about the house. And I'm sure that Simon Marr has read this book as well.
Yeah. All right, let's go to Salt Lake City, Utah. Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call. I had mentioned to your producer that I served a Fulbright to the Czech Republic, and it was Brno for my entire time. And I visited the house a number of times. And unless you actually go there, you just can't really understand. And after reading the book review, obviously the travel down memory lane, but you can't really understand just how magnificent and a little unsettling, just because it is so stunning with the modernist viewpoint, but the views and how they incorporated the property around it was just quite amazing. And so I read the review. I agree with you. I wasn't terribly impressed with the review, especially having been there. And so, you know, my intent is to pick up the book. And again, because for me, this is now a very fond, very special part of my own personal history. And I just wanted to thank you for focusing on this. The only regret I had is when I was there and visited the house the first time, I went on the website. And it's just not terribly user-friendly outside of those who speak Czech. And fortunately, my Czech was good enough that I was able to make out, you know, a bit of it, most of it, but they need to make it a little more user-friendly because it really is a treasure. Anyway, so I just wanted to pass those comments on.
I'm glad
thank you
did.
For doing that.
Thanks, Jeff. Go ahead, Bernie.
Well, I've visited the website, too. There is some interesting tension between the Czech authorities and the family. There's been significant effort on the part of family members to have the house properly restored. It went through a renovation in the 1980s that was not done well.
Czech government.
It was under the auspices of the Czech government.
Because it was turned into a museum.
Now it's a museum. The 90s, it's a museum operated by the city of Brno. There has been a lot of talk about restoration, but there's been a lot of difficulty in getting it done right and getting it done properly with and adequately resourced. And now it seems hopeful again that that's going to happen.
Mm. And the book we're talking about is titled The Glass Room. Simon Marr is the author. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. The only portion of this book that struck me as somewhat false was the ending, when Atali and Marijke meet, and they are the children of Kata, the young woman with whom Victor had an affair, and his legitimate daughter, Atali. How did you feel about that, Susan?
I had the same feeling. I thought it tied it up a little bit too neatly.
Yeah.
I mean, as these different generations of people inhabited the house, you had the sense that their lives were parallel or skew, never intersecting. And at the end, it seemed a little bit contrived, although the book is full of all sorts of coincidences. So that theme of randomness and chance that changes a life, you certainly are prepared for that sort of thing.
And Hannah talks about that kind of thing happening a lot.
Right. Hannah is another figure, another character for whom those things actually really mean a lot. It seemed like an artificially rosy and tidy ending for a book that was anything
but. What do you think, Ron?
I would have ended on the chapter before that, which is spectacular, where Hannah and Liesl are talking. And Liesl says, "Do you remember Kata? Whatever happened to her?" And Liesl says, oh, she decided not to come with us. She just vanished." And Hannah says, "Vanished? Yeah, vanished.
Yeah.
Things happen that
way
sometimes."
Doesn't say anything more.
That's such a chilling end, I think.
Yeah.
I would have stopped there.
Yeah.
I'll disagree with that.
Okay. Come on.
I mean, yes, of course, it's a coincidence at the end that the two daughters of the respective families meet. I mean, there's lots of major coincidences in the book, and novelists often create those. But I didn't see it as so as such a positive note. And in fact, the meeting is rather strained, and one doesn't really learn what happens to Kata other than that she disappeared. And all one knows about Marika is that she was an orphan in France, which means that her mother was taken away to the camps at some point and never reappeared. But we don't really know anything about that, and it's at one with the rest of the book.
Did Hannah have a real crush on Liesl?
Oh, they're deeply in love.
Deeply in love.
Yeah.
The two of them.
Now I'm talking about the fictional character.
Yes, I understand. What did you think, Ron?
Yeah, I agree.
They were deeply in love.
Some real passion and concern and affection between them that survives for decades.
Yeah, and I think Hannah's sense of heartbreak when she loses track of Liesl, to me, again, Hannah was the most interesting character, and so you sort of really sensed her being crushed by all of this. In a way, to me, Liesl never was quite believable as a character. But yeah, I think Hannah's...
pretty chilly character.
Quite chilly.
Yeah. Well, I've enjoyed this. Thank you for coming in to talk about a book I'll remember for a long time. It's titled The Glass Room. Simon Marr is the author. Susan Piedmont-Palladino, Ron Charles, Bernard Lambeck. Thank you all. And for our next reader's review, we've chosen a novel that has certainly touched a nerve with many people. Its title is The Help by Catherine Stockett. Join me Thursday, February 25th.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary on the web at healthreform.org. From the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at